Greetings, and welcome to Research on Religion, a weekly podcast series devoted to the social scientific study of religion. I'm Anthony Gill, your host, professor of political science at the University of Washington, and distinguished senior fellow at Baylor University's Institute for Studies of Religion, the gracious sponsor of our podcast. We encourage you to visit our website at www.researchonreligion.org to post comments, ask questions, access additional material related to today's program, and to find out what is happening at the Institute. All right, let's begin.
How much leeway do religious groups have in deciding the terms of employment within their organizations? This may seem like a rather mundane and self-answering question. After all, it seems reasonable that the Catholic Church should be able to hire individuals who are Catholics to staff the priesthood. Synagogues should be able to hire Jews to be rabbis, etc., etc. But the more you push this question, the more you start to run into some ambiguous territory that may bring religious organizations into conflict with federal law designed to regulate hiring practices and mitigate some forms of discrimination. For example, the Equal Employment and Opportunity Commission, the federal agency charged with enforcing anti-discrimination law in the United States, is pretty adamant that employers cannot make hiring decisions based upon race, ethnicity, gender, creed, disability, and a few other factors. Of course, there are exceptions to some of these regulations. After all, one would not expect a trucking company to hire someone who is blind as a driver. Likewise for religious groups. The Catholic Church does not recognize female priests and, as such, is given what is known as a ministerial exemption when it comes to excluding women from the hiring pool. But how far do these exemptions and exceptions go? Would the position of a grade school teacher at a private religious school be covered under such ministerial exemption? That question, in particular, was put to test in a recently decided U.S. Supreme Court decision known as Hosanna-Tabor Evangelical Lutheran Church and School versus the Equal Employment and Opportunity Commission. I would outline the details of this case for you right now, except that my head usually spins around at a dizzying pace whenever I read court documents. But it is an important case, not only for this particular Lutheran school, but also for its implications with respect to employment regulations and religious freedom. So I decided to call upon an expert in legal affairs, particularly as they relate to religion. That expert is Dr. Matthew Frank, the director of the William E. and Carol G. Simon Center on Religion and the Constitution at the Witherspoon Institute in Princeton, New Jersey. Matthew is also professor emeritus, which means he's really, really old, of political science at Radford University in Virginia, where he taught constitutional law, American politics, and political philosophy. He also chaired the Department of Political Science and is the author of the book Against the Imperial Judiciary, The Supreme Court versus the Sovereignty of the People. We'll have a link to that book up on our website, and also be sure that you check out our Facebook fan page as we are trying to make it up to 400 likes by the end of this month. Matt, good to have you on Research on Religion.
Thanks, Tony. Great to be here. Well, I'm not so old, Sonny.
Yeah, you're not.
Early retirement from Radford University, and as you may recall, when we first met, we discovered we were contemporaries at Marquette University in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. I was a very new beginning faculty member there in your senior year, so I'm not all that much older than you.
Okay. So you're basically accusing me of being old here too, huh?
Yeah, we're both, shall we say, heading towards our sunset years.
All right, well, that's okay. I'll get on my big white horse and ride off there someday, but not quite yet, because we have to talk about this important court case and some religious freedom here. This Hosanna-Tabor case, which I mentioned in the introduction, it's a big deal. So let's fill in our listening audience about the details of this case. I said I wasn't going to mention them in the introduction because, well, I get confused on some of this stuff. So what happened that put this little old Lutheran school in a big vat of hot steaming trouble known as the Supreme Court?
Okay, well, we'll get to why it's a big deal shortly, but you're right. We should start with the bare facts of the case. A teacher at a little Michigan Lutheran school, the school called Hosanna-Tabor, the church belongs to the Lutheran Church of the Missouri Synod, which is the second largest denomination of Lutherans in the country, and notably more evangelically conservative, if we can say that, than the ELCA, the Evangelical Lutheran Church in America. But you know all that stuff from your studies of religion better than I. Cheryl Perrick, P-E-R-I-C-H. Cheryl Perrick was first a kindergarten teacher, later a fourth grade teacher at this school. It being a small school, she had a lot of duties covering the waterfront, arts, language arts, religion subjects, gym, music, social studies, math. I mean, she had to do, as most teachers do at small schools like this, a lot of different subjects. But she also specifically taught a religion class,
okay,
4 days out of five, led the students in prayer in her class three times a day, devotional exercises, took the students to a weekly chapel service for all the students in the school, and herself led those chapel services about twice a year as teachers in her status normally did. Now, let me say a little bit more about her status. The school employed teachers in two categories, what they called lay teachers and called teachers, called to the ministry. Now, to be a teacher who was called to the ministry, you had to take a certain amount of Lutheran accredited religious education from an appropriate institute of higher education, and then you had to be basically chosen by the congregation. The church belonged to a parish or congregation of Lutherans, or rather, the school belonged to this congregation, and the congregation actually had to vote on this call to Ms. Perrick's ministry. So she started out as a lay teacher, and then kind of got a bump up into the really nice category of being a called teacher, which meant that she was, in Lutheran language, a commissioned minister of the Lutheran faith.
Okay, that becomes,
as her educational duties were concerned.
Yeah, that becomes an important detail here, because when I was scanning over the details of the case, I read through what Cheryl was doing at the school, and it basically said she was a grade school art teacher, basically somebody who is in charge of preventing kids from eating paste during the day. And I've scratched my head. I said, how is that a ministerial position, right?
Yeah, well, it can be. It can be a work of salvation to keep kids from eating paste.
It was back in grade school in my day, because I remember eating paste. It was
you
pretty
were a
good
paste eater. Okay,
I was.
Well,
it didn't hurt me any bit. Look at where I am now. I'm perfectly
right.
Fine. But kids, don't try this at home. If you're listening here, do not eat paste. The paste today is much much different and much more potent. So
probably more toxic.
Yeah, probably. So anyway, so she. She is a called teacher, right? She becomes
a minister.
A teacher,
okay, or a commissioned minister, and this does, you're right, become an important detail in the case. It's really the hinge on which a lot of the ministerial exemption or exception reasoning turns. She developed some health problems. She manifested a disease called narcolepsy, which actually causes people spontaneously to fall into a deep sleep in the middle of the day. And
my students.
Well, we have a narcoleptic effect on our students at times,
yeah,
don't we? But this was quite spontaneous and obviously a debilitating condition. We should feel sorry that Ms. Perrick had this. It requires some serious medical attention, and she took a leave of absence, a medical leave of absence from the school to see to this condition. And when she felt she was ready to return to the classroom. She approached her boss at the school and said she was ready. He said he didn't think she was. And this is where the impasse came about between them. Because at some point in their escalating disagreement over whether she was in fact ready to return to the classroom, and they could trust that she wasn't going to fall asleep in the middle of a class exercise, she threatened to sue them.
Okay.
And this is where she really tore it, because as far as the Missouri Synod Lutherans are concerned, it's an important article of faith that Christians do not litigate against one another. They do not sue each other over church matters, internal to the life of the faith. They just they don't do that.
It's actually an interesting point. We had a podcast earlier on our show, and we'll link back to it, about reconciliation services that are offered by religious groups and that tried to resolve this kind of stuff. But this does start winding its way through the legal system, and it really centers around this whole issue of disability. For me, it's kind of interesting to note that this takes on the ministerial exemption aspect, because I'm a little bit unsure about how the disability, okay, you're gone for, how long was she gone? For about 2 years or so?
I would have to look again at the at the factual account that Chief Justice Roberts gave. I'm not sure. It was some months at least. I'm sure it was more than a semester. But I don't know the duration of it. But the point is that when they reached this impasse where she threatened to sue and the church authorities at Hosanna Tabor got upset that she was threatening to sue, they rescinded her call.
Mm.
Her status as a called teacher. They rescinded her commission as a minister, which could only be done by a supermajority of the congregation of this little church. But they did it, and at that point, Ms. Perrick went to the EEOC, the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission, which sued the school on her behalf. Now, she intervened, which is legal jargon for joining the case as an additional party, but it was actually the litigation was instigated by the federal government, by this Washington agency, the EEOC, which was enforcing the terms of the Americans with Disabilities Act. This is an early 1990s George H.W. Bush era employment discrimination law, the ADA as it's called. It's the reason why we now have nice long, wheelchair ramps into institutional buildings and businesses of various kinds. The ADA has done great good, I think, in preventing people from being discriminated against on grounds of their disability or medical conditions. But she made out an ADA claim, and specifically because she'd been fired after threatening to sue them, she made out her claim under a very important part of the ADA. It's common to a lot of civil rights and anti-discrimination laws, which was a claim that she'd been retaliated against. And there's no stated exemption in the ADA statute for religious organizations in retaliation cases. There is a little bit of wiggle room for religious organizations in the Americans with Disabilities Act for, say, Marquette University, where you were a student, where I was a faculty member, they can prefer Catholics to others when they hire faculty, or they can insist that everyone live according to Catholic precepts and not violate the moral norms of the faith. That kind of stuff is built in to the ADA and to a lot of other important laws like the Civil Rights Act of 1964.
Let me ask you that a minute. You said that's built into the ADA, and yeah. I would think that it's built into other rules and regulations about hiring practices that the EEOC administers and monitors. But why the ADA? That would seem to be a disability. When you say, well, Marquette University can make sure that they hire Catholic folks, I mean, that's not a disability.
Yeah, it's funny. It's a good question. It seems kind of, would the word be exogenous to the statute? What does it have to do with disabilities? But I think because that kind of boilerplate language has appeared in employment discrimination law since the 1960s, when the major federal statutes began to roll out, like the Civil Rights Act of 64, that it was just included there for reasons of caution. I would be hard pressed to figure out, what case exactly would apply here. I'm a Catholic, and I happen to know a Catholic priest in Virginia who's blind from birth, and he's been admitted to the priesthood. But I don't think, for instance, that the Catholic Church would ever admit to seminary information for the priesthood a man who was missing from birth or by injury his right hand.
Why would that be?
Because there are sacramental things he has to do with his hand.
Ah, okay.
If he had no hands, if he had neither hand,
Hmm.
I once met a man born in Sweden, I think, with no arms.
Yeah.
I don't think he could be a Catholic priest.
Oh, that's interesting.
So he's handicapped. And the ADA would make an exception for the Catholic Church not admitting such a person to the priesthood.
Well, this gets at this issue of this ministerial exemption, which is put into the ADA for boilerplate, or might be put in, you know, for some reasons, as we were just talking about here, that the priest has to use his right hand, doesn't have a right hand, et cetera, et cetera. Where does this ministerial exemption come from? Is it actually codified in law at some point in time, or is it just a generally accepted norm?
Well, yeah, except for these little statutory exemptions that allow, say, religious schools to prefer people of their own faith when hiring, especially for, you know, teaching positions. Except for stuff like that, the ministerial exception is what might be called judge-made law. It's been around for four decades in the courts of appeals. That's the intermediate level of the federal courts, just below the Supreme Court, the circuit courts, as they're called. And in a number of cases over the years, virtually all the 11 geographic circuits and the D.C. Circuit in Washington have recognized a ministerial exception to employment discrimination laws on the basis of the First Amendment, on the basis of the Establishment and/or free exercise clauses of the First Amendment. But the Supreme Court, until Hosanna Tabor was decided in January 2012, had never, in those 40 years, taken one of those cases on appeal and addressed the question directly itself. That's why this was a big deal when it finally did get to the Supreme Court. Ms. Parrott's case first went to a district court judge in the federal system in Michigan, and she actually lost there decisively when the school asked for a summary judgment, that is, dismissed the case without even having a trial of the issues, on the basis of the ministerial exception, saying, look, you know, we can't be interfered with as a religious school in making an employment decision relating to one of our commissioned ministers, which she was. And we've said she's not anymore, and you can't second-guess that. And the judge agreed, and he threw out the case. But then it went to the Sixth Circuit Court of Appeals. The Sixth Circuit covers several states in the upper Midwest, including Michigan and Ohio and Indiana, I believe.
Well, let me stop you there, yeah. Because this legal stuff, of all the stuff in political science, the judiciary always tends to befuddle me, especially the American judiciary. Mm-hmm. So Ms. Parrott loses big at the first district case, or at the first district level, right? And they say on a summary judgment, hey, come on. You don't have a basis for this. Go home. We're sorry you lost your job, but there's probably something out there. We'll see you around. Mm-hmm. Why isn't that the end of it? Why? What gives her a basis for appeal? It seems that that's a pretty resounding no. Go home. Why do you get to take it to the next level?
The system is set up on three levels precisely in order to facilitate appellate rulings on whether the court below got the law correct. Generally, appeals courts don't reconsider factual questions, although there are times when they'll do even that. But they're always open to a timely and jurisdictionally sound claim that someone a judge below has gotten the law wrong. And so the claim, and this was pressed by the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission, the EEOC on behalf of Ms. Parrott appealed to the Sixth Circuit saying, look, the judge below just got the law wrong. We don't think that the ministerial exception applies to Ms. Parrott's case because she's just like all the other teachers, including the lay teachers in her school. And she does all kinds of things that are unrelated to being a religious minister, like teaching the kids math, for goodness sake.
Yeah.
So that was the government's claim, and the Sixth Circuit actually sided with the government.
Okay. So they sided with the EEOC. My big question is, why doesn't every case just get appealed up the line then? Because it would just seem so easy to say, hey, I got a bad judgment at the district court. The judge doesn't know what he's talking about. Let's go up one more level.
Well, it's actually, you know, I think it's the rare case in which a lawyer for a losing party at the district level doesn't appeal. But But the next level up, the circuit court, they have a certain amount of discretion, whether to accept the appeal, whether to act on it in a thorough way. They can find ways to dismiss appeals out of hand, and a lot of appeals are dismissed out of hand. And at the highest level of the judiciary, the U.S. Supreme Court, they have enormous discretion to take cases or to leave them resolved at the lower level. It's called the petition for the writ of certiorari, a bit of legal Latin, and there are thousands of petitions every year to the Supreme Court, and they take fewer than 100 cases.
Yeah.
So their discretion to control their docket, and that's why although for 40 years the ministerial exception had been rattling around in the lower federal courts, including all 12 district or circuit courts, it had never risen to the Supreme Court. They had just declined all opportunities to hear a ministerial exception case until this one came along.
Actually, I want to pause and step outside the Hosanna Tabor case for a minute. Have there been other ministerial exemption challenges that have been out there? I mean, they don't go up to the Supreme Court, but they're rattling down at the district level and maybe the circuit court level.
Yeah, I'll give you an example. At Catholic University, there was a woman, a nun, who wanted to be a member of the theology, or I think perhaps the canon law faculty at Catholic University. It's a very important department in the life of the church, and when she was denied an appointment to the canon law faculty, she sued under Title IX sex discrimination, and she lost because the circuit court said, look, you know, the teaching of canon law, and like, say, the teaching of physics over in some other department at Catholic University, is so bound up with the integrity of the church, we're not going to interfere under the guise of a sex discrimination suit with what's basically a religious decision about employing a canon law professor. And you, in fact, are in a religious order yourself. You're a nun, and so you actually have the weakest kind of claim, because you yourself are a kind of religious minister who the terms of whose employment fall into the ministerial exception. We just can't adjudicate that. We can't interfere in that kind of internal church decision-making about a nun and whether she gets to be a canon law professor. If it was a lay woman who was complaining that a bunch of guys in the physics department wouldn't hire her, but she was better qualified than the guy they hired, that would be a different kind of case, and even Catholic University would have to answer for that.
I would imagine that there's a lot of these challenges increasingly coming to the courts, because as we add layer upon layer to our anti-discrimination hiring laws, that this is going to bump up against a lot of things. I mean, you just mentioned Title IX there, right? That's a whole new layer. We had the Americans with Disability Act that we were talking about before, the Civil Rights Act. So, wow, I mean, are these cases actually starting to increase in number? I imagine in the 1800s it wasn't a big deal, because everybody says, well, of course a Lutheran's going to hire a Lutheran. And that's just how things are. But nowadays, you have so many competing groups and claims that you could see how some of these things are going to conflict over time.
Well, one of the effects of Hosanna Tabor, we haven't come to the outcome of the case, but it didn't go Ms. Parrick's way. And one effect of that case might be that the number of lawsuits against religious organizations could decline, because people will see... Now, lawyers, of course, will try and find corners and angles and crevices in the opinion of the court and press these lawsuits anyway. But I think there could be a modest decline in the cases where employment discrimination is charged against a religious organization, because people will throw up their hands and say, look, you know, thanks to Hosanna Tabor, we don't have a prayer of winning this case. So, that's one possible effect. But because we have a very religiously diverse society with a vibrant private sector of civil society involved in religious devotion, religious education, charitable ministries, and because we have an increasingly pervasive regulatory state in healthcare, in employment discrimination, and so on and so on. These conflicts are just going to keep arriving, and we'll have to sort out who gets the ministerial exception, what situations this are governed by this norm, and what aren't.
Well, that brings us back to what the district level does here. And so I want to take it back to the Hosanna-Tabor case. We'll talk about the implications of this at the Supreme Court level a little bit later on here. And you did provide a spoiler by telling us that Hosanna-Tabor won and Ms. Parrick didn't. But you know, folks, don't worry. We got more stuff coming, so stay tuned. At the district level, I'm interested in trying to figure out how they differed from the circuit court. Or I should say the circuit court differed from the district, because district court says, get out of here, you knuckleheads, this, you don't have any standing.
Yeah.
But the circuit court reverses that. Why?
Well, the circuit court decided to do a fairly fact-intensive look at Ms. Parrick's situation. They held that there was such a thing as a ministerial exception from anti-discrimination laws, but they thought that the district court should have looked closely at this school's daily life and Ms. Parrick's part in that daily life at the school, and see just how much sort of religion she's doing. You know, if she's spending, only 23% of her time in religious devotions, leading prayer groups, religious education curriculum, but in the rest, 77% of her time is dealing with math, art, music, social studies, history.
Keeping those kids from eating paste.
Then the court, I don't know how they parsed this in terms of percentages, but they did actually talk about how many hours in the week she did X, Y, and Z.
Wow.
And they said, look, she's not doing enough religion here to be like, Reverend Blücher, who's a Lutheran minister with a collar on. She's just like the lay teachers in everything she does, except that she's called a called teacher and a commissioned minister. That was the Sixth Circuit's analysis of it. They concluded that in her case, the ministerial exception didn't apply because she didn't do enough religion stuff in the school.
That seems to be a fairly arbitrary line to draw, though. I mean, what's the difference between 25% walking around praying or 26.2% or 13%? It seems to be a pretty big judgment call there, which in many ways would give courts a substantial degree of power over determining employment.
It would,
stuff.
And the Supreme Court has been warning for 40 years in cases of other kinds regarding the First Amendment religion clauses, that we don't want an entanglement of church and state in which government gets too involved in the life of religious organizations and vice versa. And boy, if there's a recipe for entangling the federal courts with the life of religious institutions, it's the kind of analysis that the Sixth Circuit did here. And so that's why the school decided to go the extra mile and challenge this at the Supreme Court. Now, they got help. They got super lawyers.
Yeah, I want to ask about that because, so Hosanna-Tabor School loses at the circuit level.
Yeah.
And by this time, legal fees got to be piling up. And I'm sure they got some pro bono help. Maybe somebody in the school's dad was a lawyer, or mom was a lawyer. Some say, hey, we'll help you out here at the lower levels. But, as this thing goes up, it's going to be a lot more time consuming, a lot more expensive.
Yeah.
I don't know about the Lutheran folks out there in Michigan, but me, I would have said, okay, I lost this case. Yeah, you can have your job back. I don't know. So the it's starting to pile up. So as you mentioned, they get help. They get super lawyers. I like that term, super lawyers.
There were heavyweights on both sides of this case. I'm not sure when the super lawyers got involved. It might have been at the district level, but certainly by the time you reach the Supreme Court and probably the Circuit Court too, A big public interest law firm in Washington, where, full disclosure, I have friends, called the Beckett Fund for Religious Liberty, got involved.
Okay.
The Beckett Fund is named for the Catholic saint Thomas Becket, who squared off against King Henry II of England about the rights of the church against the crown and so on. And this is all they do. The Beckett Fund for Religious Liberty is its full name, and it's all they do is litigate religious freedom cases.
Now, are they going out there and looking for these cases, or Hosanna Tabor call them up and say, hey, this is getting expensive, help?
I'm not sure who found whom, Tony, but okay. They found each other, and to Hosanna Tabor's great good fortune, the Beckett Fund engaged terrific attorneys. The lead attorney who briefed the case and did the oral arguments on behalf of the school in the Supreme Court was Professor Douglas Laycock of the University of Virginia Law School, who has been one of the leading scholars on First Amendment religion law for over 30 years in this country. And he's a very big deal and a very persuasive advocate. And I don't know, I don't know anything about the fee structure there or what Professor Laycock charges, but he's a big deal, and he's not known as a particularly conservative guy. I mean, I think his own politics are fairly liberal, but he's a great defender of religious freedom, and he really went to bat for the school in a very effective way. And the argument was, look, the Sixth Circuit has made a mistake here because they're going to get, they're going to draw, a precedent like this would draw courts into the thicket of trying to figure out what's religious and what's not religious and who's a called teacher, commission minister, who's not. Too much second guessing and minute factual analysis of this kind would interfere unjustly in the internal life of religious ministries and institutions. So that was the claim they took up to the Supreme Court. And a lot of people thought, well, the usual falling out of the four conservatives, the four liberals, Justice Kennedy in the middle, what will Justice Kennedy do? Various other analyses were offered about how the case would come out.
And wait. I'm going to stop you there because I don't want you to reveal how this comes out. We already kind of know that Hosanna Tabor wins.
Yeah, sorry.
But I want to know, getting here between the circuit and the Supreme Court. So yeah. Hosanna Tabor gets some assistance by the Beckett Fund. Does the EEOC get anybody supporting them? They say, you guys are bringing in the big guns with Beckett Fund. We're going to find some people or some other interested groups, maybe just go to the EEOC and say, hey, we'll help you out here.
Well, Ms. Parrick had her own representation, and since, remember, she's also a party to the case, and I'm not sure who was picking up the costs of that. I really don't know. But I do know that she had high-powered attorneys on her side. She had a former Solicitor General, Walter Dellinger, who had worked in the Clinton administration, and she had a lawyer in private practice who's now Deputy Solicitor General in the Obama administration, but wasn't at the time this case was argued, and he's a nominee for the D.C. Circuit Court, an Indian-born fellow named Sri Srinivasan. You have lawyers, for Ms. Parrick, like that, somebody thinks that her case is important and is swinging in behind her. So it's kind of like the battle of the public interest attorneys.
Yeah, and this fascinates me about these cases that do make it up to the Supreme Court. And we had one out here involving Northwest College, which is now Northwest University, about the Blaine Amendments and, how this all just starts. And I'm a nuts and bolts guy. I like to think about the step-by-step process is that, at some day back in 1999, 1998, Cheryl walks into the office, say, hey, I want my job back. And they say, we can't really do that. There's some argument in the office. And a couple days later, you're all of a sudden in the Supreme Court. I mean, not a couple days, but
yeah,
it happens.
It's extraordinary how these things happen, isn't it?
And how, bigger movements, bigger than perhaps the individuals involved in these things, really get involved in this because these bring up huge philosophical, legal philosophical issues.
Like that old Dave Edmonds song, "From Small Things, Mama, Big Things One Day Come."
Yeah.
You're right. What starts out as a minor dispute about whether a teacher is well enough to return to the classroom escalates into a great battle of public interest law firms against one another, representing these sort of not very deep pockets private parties, and you've got the federal government involved. Remember, the third party here, or actually one of the two principal parties in the case, is the EEOC, and they're represented as a government agency by the Solicitor General's office in the Department of Justice. The Solicitor General is the country's top lawyer who argues in the Supreme Court. He or she and the Deputy Solicitors General in that office. So they're in the court as well. And when the argument was heard in the Hosanna Tabor case, you actually had three lawyers come to the podium to argue the case. Doug Laycock for Hosanna Tabor, and then these other lawyers for the federal government and for Ms. Parrick as well.
Now, how does that happen? I mean, you get a decision at the circuit court level, yeah, and Hosanna Tabor says, ugh, that's really disappointing, but oh, hey, the Beckett Fund is helping us out here. They go up to the Supreme Court. Would you just knock on the door saying, hey, we want a hearing, or
no,
is there...
There's all sorts of very precise rules and procedures for filing a petition for a writ of certiorari, which is the technical jargon for an appeal from the Sixth Circuit to the U.S. Supreme Court. Then the court has to consider the petition. Clerks get involved in the justices' offices. The justices have to take a vote. If four justices agree to take a case that has been petitioned for review, four out of nine, then the case will be heard. Of course, four is not a majority, and so if only four vote to take a case, they could be a bit uncertain about how it's going to come out. Are they going to wind up on the losing side after having decided the case was important enough to hear? So more often than not, I think cases that reach the threshold of four probably have more than four votes to hear them. We don't know, because these deliberations are kept secret by the Supreme Court.
And that makes sense.
Exactly how many justices voted to hear this case.
Yeah, it makes sense that you have not a majority of justices deciding to take a case, because then that almost would sound that the case is decided beforehand, but
yeah,
you want to have...
Yeah, it sounds very much like yeah, you're deciding on the merits.
Yeah, you want to decide... You know, we want to have a minority bring up, or a close to the majority minority, and
right,
say, okay, maybe now the arguments can be heard, and the arguments can win over one or two or three,
exactly,
different judges here. So,
yeah,
what is happening when this case is brought up? They go through the filtering process and bringing this up, and it looks like the Supreme Court is going to hear this.
Yeah.
I can imagine there's going to be some chatter among the pundit class. Maybe this isn't headline news on CBS, but it certainly is going to be discussed by people who pay attention to a lot of these issues. What was the thinking at the time that the Supreme Court decides to hear this case?
Well, when the court decided to put this on the docket and it heard oral arguments early in the fall of 2011, among religious liberty scholars and lawyers and activists, First Amendment people, there was a lot of intense interest in the case, because if you knew anything about the pattern of ministerial exception cases in the lower courts, you also knew that no case had ever yet been decided in four decades by the Supreme Court. Aha, we're going to get something authoritative, something decisive that will guide all the lower courts. So in that little community, that audience, or public, as we might say, was very attentive to the case, and there was a lot of speculation. People just didn't know. They certainly didn't know exactly what shape the outcome would take, and a lot of people were surprised by that, by the shape of the outcome, not just who won, but in what fashion they won. And so we haven't spoiled that surprise yet.
Yeah, don't do that.
But I think there was a lot of nail biting, you know, while this case was being heard. Yeah, but you know, once it's put on the docket, then written briefs are submitted, amicus briefs, amicus curiae, friend of the court briefs are submitted by lots of people who have an interest in the issues of the case. The court takes a lot of those friend of the court briefs, and then of course the oral arguments are scheduled, and those last usually an hour. And the justices do a lot of interrupting of the lawyers and posing bizarre hypotheticals to test the limits of their logic and so on. So people in the biz, you know, of watching religious freedom litigation, They got to read the briefs, in some cases to write some of the briefs if they were interested enough to do that. I was not involved in any of that. And then when the oral arguments here, everybody's, you know, breathless to read the transcript of that. How'd they do? What signals do we get from the justices about how they're going to vote? What sort of strategy did the lawyers employ as they tried to persuade the justices? Did anybody put a foot wrong? Did any of the lawyers say something that you say, oh my gosh, what a tactical mistake that was? So that kind of super fine-grained analysis was very commonly going on among the legal bloggers and experts in this field as the case progressed.
Before we get to what their feeling was, I have to ask this, because this happens around this time of year when the Supreme Court hears a number of different cases, then goes into chambers, and you know, all you constitutional law folks get just absolutely giddy. And you hear people saying, oh, you know, this lawyer had this flinch and that kind of flinch. I mean, when I look at this stuff, I'm like, oh, you know what? I can wait a couple months. I'm not too worried about this stuff. You guys really, you constitutional law folks, you get all jazzed at this time of year?
Yeah, especially don't get behind one of us and say boo around the 6th of June, because that means that there's just 2 weeks left in which major Supreme Court cases we've been waiting for months to hear about are going to be handed down.
Okay.
Just, you know, the Supreme Court typically leaves its most important cases for the end of the term, and they always try to get out of Washington before July begins, so they can have some vacation time before they return on the first Monday of October. Late June is a very tense time. Now, Hosanna Tabor was interesting because it was argued very early, I think in probably in October of 2011. I have it here, October 5th. Yeah, it was like on the third day of the term. So they argued it on October 5th, and then a decision was not delayed much at all. One of the earliest decisions of that term that begins each October, it came down in January.
Okay, so that one came pretty quick. But let's go through the arguments on each side now. We've somewhat reviewed what they are at the district and circuit court level, but I'm interested in if these things modified or changed as it gets to the Supreme Court level. Let's start with the main arguments from the side of the EEOC and Ms. Parrish.
Yeah, here's where something very interesting happened at the Supreme Court level that had not been seen, as far as I know, at the circuit court level. At the circuit court, you'll recall, the Sixth Circuit was persuaded by the government that although there is such a thing as a ministerial exemption based on the First Amendment, Ms. Parrish's case did not fall within that exception, and therefore she could go forward with their claim against the school. At the Supreme Court, the government's argument and Ms. Parrish's lawyer's argument essentially was that the First Amendment provides no unique ministerial exception for religious institutions, ministries, organizations under the religion clauses of the First Amendment. And this was a stunner. This rocked some of the justices back in their big leather chairs behind the bench of the Supreme Court. It was a jaw dropper because for 40 years circuit courts had been saying there's a ministerial exception based on the religion clauses of the First Amendment. And here's the federal government, the Obama Justice Department, officially saying, and they're teamed up with Ms. Parrish's lawyer saying the same thing, no, you know what, there really isn't. There really isn't any First Amendment, freedom of religion-based ministerial exception to the country's anti-discrimination laws. Now, when they were pressed on this by justices in oral argument, and the classic easy hypothetical was employed of, what about the Catholic Church not letting women be priests, for instance, or insisting that they not only be men, but be Catholic men to be priests. Well, the lawyers for Parrish and the EEOC said, well, that would be covered under a general sort of right of free association that is enjoyed by anyone else, the Kiwanis Club, a labor union, whoever, and this was absolutely stunning to virtually all the justices, and may have been a strategic blunder by the government and Ms. Parrick's lawyers, because they said, no, wait a minute. Kind of a general freedom of association derived from the free speech and assembly clauses of the First Amendment, that we get as something that anyone, religious or non-religious, can claim. But there's also these very important religion clauses, the very first clauses of the First Amendment, and you're saying that there's nothing uniquely springing from those clauses that sets religious organizations apart as especially having an exception from the anti-discrimination laws? And the government said, that's right, that's what we're arguing. So this was seen far and wide as a gambit by the administration, the Obama administration, that was could be seen as overtly hostile to the claims of religious freedom. This was the most anti-religious freedom thing they could possibly have said in a case like this, and they'd gone ahead and said it. So they were going all out to have the Supreme Court come down with an authoritative ruling to guide all the federal courts in the country that would say basically all those federal courts for 40 years have been wrong to see a specifically religious type of exception to the anti-discrimination laws in this country. There's a kind of generalized freedom of association exception we might find in some cases, but you see that's far more easily overcome by invoking how important it is to fight discrimination.
I might be jumping the gun here a little bit and talking about the implications, but that freedom of association argument, if the case went against them, as we know that it did, wouldn't that just open the door then, that argument saying, well, any group, religious or not, that has, you know, certain values that they might want to associate with, that would exempt them from the EEOC as well?
Well, I think that the reason the government used this freedom of association alternative as the only kind of exception they would recognize is that it's more easily overcome by the countervailing force of the government's compelling interest in fighting employment discrimination.
I see.
So it was a way of offering up the fig leaf of some kind of exception, rarely granted, easily overcome, and a way of radically weakening the case on behalf of Hosanna Tabor Church and School by saying, look, there's nothing, you know, if there's another school down the road from you that's like a private Tony prep school that has no religious character at all, they could have freedom of association claims. But we know perfectly well that a school like that would never get away with employment discrimination on freedom of association grounds. So if they're going to assimilate the Hosanna Tabor school to that secular private school, what they're really saying is they shouldn't get away with it either. They're offering up the freedom of association claim as an alternative to the religious liberty claim is a way of trading, you know, something strong as a fresh 2x4 for a rotten branch to lean upon. It's going to break under you.
Yeah. Yeah, I can kind of see how that is argued. It is kind of a sneaky way, and that's why lawyers are so sneaky.
Lawyers are sneaky. There's a couple of political scientists talking. We can say that.
Right. Yeah. So what is how does Hosanna Tabor's side and the Beckett Fund, etc., respond to this?
Well, they responded with expressions of incredulity that the government should be arguing that the First Amendment religion clauses provide nothing special to religious organizations.
Did they know that this was going to be the argument? Did the EEOC and the Solicitor General's office have to reveal their arguments before they stood before the justices?
It was set down in writing in the briefs, and there's often more than one round of brief writing. So when the petitioning party gets to offer arguments first. That was Hosanna Tabor, because they lost in the circuit court.
Yeah.
So they offered their brief. The government and Ms. Parrick offered their briefs, and then Hosanna Tabor got to file what's called a reply brief in writing, which is a response to the government and Parrick. And in the reply brief, Mr. Laycock, the UVA law professor, and his co-counsel, they said, wow, you know, this is not an argument we heard at the circuit level. And for the first time, the government is saying that basically there's no such thing as a ministerial exception. There's just a really weak, watery freedom of association exception, which is almost always going to lose. So this is new. This is the government turning its back on 40 years of circuit court precedents that we think the Supreme Court should affirm and strengthen with an authoritative ruling, and turning its back, moreover, on the text of the Constitution, which says, you know, free exercise of religion, and so on. And when the oral arguments came, I have to say that the justices were very skeptical of the government's argument across the board. You know, many of the justices said, are you really claiming this? Are you really saying no ministerial exception based on the First Amendment religion clauses? And the government, you know, I think they realized that they were in a tough corner with a tough argument, and they tried in that lawyerly way instead of answering yes or no to the question, do you affirm or deny a ministerial exception under the religion clauses? They said, well, we think it's like freedom of association. And Chief Justice Roberts said, well, that's a no, right? You're saying no. There's no religious liberty claim here. Yeah. And finally, they were, you know, backed into that corner and said, that's right. That's what we're claiming.
Wow. So yeah. You constitutional law experts and all the other pundits out there, what, after seeing the arguments, after reading the briefs, what were you thinking? You said this is going to be a slam dunk case one way or the other, or it's going to be a 5-4 split in favor of one group or the other. How was the chattering class and academics thinking about this?
Well, honestly, I was thinking that, number one, the court would reject the government's argument that there's no ministerial exception. But number two, would the court say that the ministerial exception applied to this case, I was less sure about. Remember, the Sixth Circuit had said that there is an exception.
Yeah.
But it doesn't apply here. So the Sixth Circuit had said that there is a ministerial exception, but it doesn't apply here. I kind of expected the Supreme Court would say, yes, there's a ministerial exception. And that would be important because the Supreme Court had never said that before. But then I was less certain about whether they would accept Hosanna Tabor's argument that the exception applied here. They might follow the Sixth Circuit and say, well, she doesn't do enough religion, and basically buy into that very fact-specific analysis of, you know, getting tangled up in how much praying or devotional exercises people are involved in. The other alternative, of course, was that they would say that there's a ministerial exception. We have to do this kind of fact-specific analysis, and this case is one that merits the exception. What I didn't expect was a kind of blanket ruling that was as big a win as it was on virtually all fronts. The case came out kind of surprising.
And tell us what that big surprise win was.
The big surprise win was 9-0.
Whoa. Okay, so that doesn't happen that often on the Supreme Court, I take it.
No. Well, it does on less important cases.
Okay.
There's a, you know, if you follow the Supreme Court closely and you get those emails with, you know, the news of the latest decisions that I get, you say, oh yeah, okay, there was something else, something on federal pensions law there, you know, this is unanimously decided. Okay, no big surprise. But these big Bill of Rights cases, these important cases involving, you know, essential freedoms of the American people, they're contentious, they're tinged with ideological disputes, they're subject to all sorts of interpretive pushes and pulls based on different approaches to reading the Constitution, and you don't expect 9-0. So this was big. It was 9-0 in favor of the school, in favor of there being a ministerial exception, and totally in favor of the school having the last word on whether somebody is a called teacher or commissioned minister in the Lutheran Church.
And did this put the folks who were arguing for limiting the ministerial exception back on their heels? Was this a big jaw dropper for the other? I mean, it was obviously Hosanna Tabor and the Beckett Fund walked out of the Supreme Court saying, yay, we won. But yeah. What about the other side?
Well, the other side was decisively put on notice that their extreme argument was a bad loser. Their extreme argument that there's no religious exemption under the religious clauses of the First Amendment. They have to abandon that. It's totally rejected by all nine justices. There's not going to be, like you might have with a 5-4 case, a chance to revisit this in future and get the precedent overturned. This will never be overturned. Let's be realistic, you know? Unanimous Supreme Court rulings just don't get overturned. Because, you know, you need some justice dissenting whose view can be vindicated in future, right? Yeah. Well, there isn't one. They're all in agreement. There was an opinion for the unanimous court by Chief Justice Roberts, the chief himself, and then there were short concurring opinions by Justice Thomas and Justice Alito. And Alito was joined by Kagan, a conservative joined by a liberal. And what Thomas and Alito had to say in their concurring opinions only added to what Roberts said. Didn't actually disagree with anything he said. So you've got a really, really decisive loss for the Obama administration here. And I think it is put on notice that it's virtually overt hostility to a religious freedom claim was unacceptable. In fact, Chief Justice Roberts used language like remarkable, untenable, and let me see if I can find my favorite here. We find this position untenable. We cannot accept this remarkable view. That's about it, I guess.
Okay. There's some pretty strong adjectives there.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, I love this, but we cannot accept the remarkable view, said Chief Justice Roberts, that the religion clauses have nothing to say about a religious organization's freedom to select its own ministers. Okay. And that's what the Obama people had been saying. So, yeah, I think they should have been rocked back on their heels. Now, this doesn't foreclose all future cases where the government might try to come back and say the ministerial exception doesn't apply. But it's pretty much a blanket get out of the EEOC free card for avowedly religious schools, ministries, charitable organizations, to the extent that they designate employees as involved in the ministerial life of the enterprise.
Okay, so you just mentioned something interesting there. You said churches and charitable organizations and schools. So you start to broaden who this applies to. I mean, obviously it applies to a church, a religious denomination, right? Catholic church. Religious schools, that expands that a little bit more. Charitable organizations, that starts to get a little bit bigger. We might be talking Salvation Army here,
yeah,
or groups like that. What is the broader impact of this decision? And I bring this up because recently with the challenges to the HHS mandate to the Patient Protection Act, the Obamacare, there's concern over private employers being mm-hmm. able to hire based upon their own conscience. And I'm wondering to what extent Hosanna Tabor will have implications there. And let me just give you a little bit of a hypothetical here. That here recently in the state of Washington, the citizens passed a referendum, or I should say initiative, legalizing same-sex marriage.
Mm-hmm.
And there might be somebody who's in a business, and we've already had a lawsuit where somebody didn't want to make a wedding cake for a same-sex couple, and now the churches or the state is going after them in a lawsuit. But what would happen in terms of employment, thinking a little bit more narrowly, somebody of who's Catholic has an employee, and then all of a sudden they find out that this person is going to have a same-sex marriage, and they have a conscientious objection to that. Is Hosanna Tabor one of these cases that's going to come up to think about that kind of issue in the future?
And not directly with the private employers in the for-profit sector. It's interesting. There are three categories of institutions that are affected by the HHS mandate. There's religious employers like churches themselves. There's religiously affiliated nonprofits like a Hosanna Tabor or a Notre Dame or Gonzaga University out in Washington. And then there's everyone else, and the everyone else would be other nonprofits that aren't religiously affiliated, and all for-profit enterprises like Hobby Lobby or like Tyndall House Publishers, which publishes Bibles but is actually a profit-making publisher. For those for-profit corporations and privately held enterprises that that employ people and don't want to have the government breathing down their neck about things they regard as important for religious reasons, I'm afraid Hosanna Tabor is not really going to be any help, because it's about Hosanna Tabor is about religious organizations and their right to control their integrity as ministries of a faith, and as important as the faith of the owners of Hobby Lobby is to those people. They're not actually a church or a ministry of faith, even in the way, say, Gonzaga University is. Now, that doesn't mean that they're bound to lose their cases. In fact, the HHS mandate cases are going along pretty swimmingly for these for-profit employers. In about 10 out of 12 cases so far, they're winning injunctions against the HHS mandate, but not because of anything in Hosanna Tabor. They're winning where they are winning because of something known as RFRA, the Religious Freedom Restoration Act of 1993. Mm-hmm. And that opens up a whole other can of worms. It would have to, I think, be another interview.
Yeah, we've talked about RFRA and RLUIPA, the Religious Land Use and Institutionalized Persons Act, on a number of these things, as well as the court cases against the HHS mandate. We'll link to those on our website. We've had some great discussions with folks like Philip Munoz about this issue. Here's another case, and I, with the remaining time we have, I just want to throw out another hypothetical, is the Boy Scouts of America, and that's coming up too. They're not a private employer. They're a largely volunteer organization. They're not really a church organization, or they are faith-based, but wow, they allow every faith imaginable. You take a look at the awards that Scouts could win for working with their own faith tradition. It's everything from Judaism to Christianity to Islam to Buddhism. It's all there. And they are facing right now a lot of pressure to change their position on issue of same-sex, or I shouldn't say same-sex scoutmasters, but gay scoutmasters, openly gay scoutmasters. And do they get to have a ministerial exception? They're not a church. They're not a private enterprise.
That's an interesting question. The Boy Scouts of America are not a church. They accept boys and scoutmasters from every faith tradition. So it's an interesting question whether they are involved in exercising religion. You know, the free exercise of religion is what's protected by the First Amendment. They do ask their boys and their scoutmasters all to affirm a belief in God. So no one who is openly and avowedly an atheist is allowed to be a scout or a scoutmaster. The fact that they do that might aid them in making a kind of Hosanna Tabor type of claim, but that's a bit of a reach. You know, 13 years ago, in the year 2000, the Boy Scouts of America won a lawsuit against the government officials here in New Jersey, where I am, under state law, which tried to force them to accept gay scoutmasters. This is a state-level anti-discrimination law that included sexual orientation, which federal law does not. Federal law does not, at present, include any category of sexual orientation as protected class against employment discrimination.
I did not know
and
that.
They took this. The Boy Scouts took this case all the way to the Supreme Court and won on that freedom of association argument that the government was offering up in Hosanna Tabor as the only argument available to churches too. So they I think, you know, and that was a divided decision. I think they barely squeaked by, maybe 5-4, 6-3, something like that. And their case would have been stronger if they'd been making the argument, hey, we're a religious ministry. But they didn't make that argument. They made a freedom of association argument. And if we ever had a federal law that included sexual orientation in the categories of persons against whom you can't discriminate, then I think the Boy Scouts case would crumble pretty quickly. The freedom of association claim might not be so strong any longer. But it did win. It did win for them in 2000 in Boy Scouts of America versus Dale. It's tough. You know, a lot of our looming conflicts are coming along because of the press for same-sex marriage, civil unions, non-discrimination laws regarding gay people. You have that case of the baker in Washington State. I saw recently a case involving a bed and breakfast owner in Hawaii.
Right. Yeah, so those cases are going to be kind of coming to the fore, and it'll be interesting how all of this plays out. Let's get back to the Hosanna Tabor case, and as we conclude here, you have a chance to look at this case. You're very interested in it, but you're also very interested in broader issues of religious freedom, specifically with your work there at the Witherspoon Institute. What is your big takeaway from this case? What, you know, religious liberty cases at the Supreme Court level have swung a little bit like a pendulum over the past 50 years. Sometimes it seems to be going against churches and their freedoms. Other times it seems to be going in favor of them. Where does this case put us in that landscape? And where do you see religious freedom issues at the Supreme Court level or society more general going in the next couple decades?
Yeah, it's very big question. Interesting question, Tony. I try not to get in the prediction business too much. I can see problems on the horizon with religious liberty claims in an environment in which government tries to force employers to supply contraceptives. For instance, there's the HHS mandate, or government tries to force people to accept gay couples as married despite their religious belief that such marriages are impossible or not to be recognized. I'm not sure where things are going to go, but the good news out of Hosanna Tabor for defenders of religious liberty is that the case was unanimous, it was so strong, and there's language in it that might creep out of the confines of the employment discrimination field into other fields. Language about the importance of the integrity of religious institutions to have the last word about what defines themselves as far as their religious mission is concerned. And if you're a church leader and you have to find a redoubt, a stronghold to defend your institutional integrity against assaults from the state, and that's the future we might be looking at, language like this in Hosanna Tabor provides a bit of comfort that, you know, that you have at least some justices willing to say that religious freedom is not just for individuals in their homes, in their private worship, or in what they do on Sundays or Saturdays if they're Jewish, or Fridays if they're Muslim. Religious freedom is about religious communities and their ability to define their own identity with integrity. That, I think, is a big takeaway from Hosanna Tabor that was very good news for us.
Well, that is a very interesting summary of the case, and it's something that we'll have to be watching as we move forward throughout the next several years and as these cases may wind their way through the court. So, Matt, I want to thank you for being on Research on Religion.
Thanks, Tony. Glad to be with you.
Thank you for listening to Research on Religion. To learn more about today's topic, participate in a discussion about what you've heard, or browse other podcasts, please visit our website at www.researchonreligion.org. And if you like what we're doing, please tell a friend. We'd appreciate the company. See you next week.